Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. See tuna, think buffalo. That's my takeaway from Richard Ellis's new book on the great fish. Ellis loves the tuna as ocean athlete and evolutionary marvel. Most of the world loves it as lunch. The big ones are going and gone, and the rest are in trouble unless we can learn how to farm them. This hour on Point, the fate of the tuna. You can join the conversation. Have you ever hooked or harpooned a big one? Will someone alive today hook or harpoon the last for sushi? We will hear later this hour from the man who caught the biggest tuna ever, 1,496 pounds of tuna in that fish. Ken Frazier will join us from Nova Scotia. But first, joining me in the studio is Richard Ellis, author and marine artist, who has written and illustrated for National Geographic, Discover, and Scientific American. He's written up whales, squid, and shark. His new book is Tuna, A Love Story. Richard Ellis, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much, Tom.
A love story. Are you playing with Oscar Wilde there as well?
I did at one point. I said everybody kills the thing he loves, but Oscar Wilde probably wasn't talking about fish.
You call tuna the world's favorite fish. What do you mean by that?
Well, most of the tuna that people eat, the canned tuna, is not the subject of this book, even though it's mentioned in the book. Canned tuna is either albacore, which is white meat tuna, or skipjack, which is light meat tuna. Mm-hmm. Those fish are plentiful. They are not endangered. The bluefin tuna is the red meat tuna that the Japanese are hunting so intensively, not only on the open sea, but hunting by buying them from everybody else. And it's the Japanese that are endangering this fish.
So you're talking about the bluefin, that's the biggest of the big, the sort of king of the tuna crowd. Describe it for us as a creature.
It is a bullet-shaped creature, so perfectly designed, and I'm a little leery about using the word designed here, but its components are well enough put together so that it could very well be the epitome of fish design. It's faster, it's more maneuverable, it is sleeker, it has slots into which its fins all fit when it's zooming through the water. Its dorsal fin lies down and that fits in a slot. So you have this projectile-shaped creature that is designed for movement, and tuna never, never stop moving.
They can't stop moving, like shark. Why?
Well, some sharks actually can.
Oh, okay.
Tuna can't because they need this constant oxygen supply to feed their muscles, to keep them going. A tuna that is trapped in a net will drown. It's hard to imagine a fish drowning.
A tuna fish will drown.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, some sharks will also drown. Mm-hmm. But no question about it, if they keep the tuna trapped in a net so that it can't move, not so that it can't breathe because it doesn't come to the surface. It breathes water, of course, like all fish do. But if it's trapped in a net, it will drown.
Your bluefin tuna, not the fastest of all fish, but very darn fast, right up there it with the top speeders.
Very, very close. I mean, it's very difficult, obviously, to clock a fish, but there have been experiments with sailfish, which are generally regarded as the fastest swimming of all fish, and they've been clocked at 68 miles an hour. Tuna have been clocked at 55 miles an hour, and it's a marvelous thing to watch these fish move, whether it's in the wild or in a tank.
Describe it.
In Monterey, at the Monterey Bay Aquarium in California.
Famous, beautiful. Been there,
giant,
love it.
Well, I love it. But I love it because I get to stand in front of this huge tank, a million-gallon tank, which has mostly bluefin and yellowfin tuna in it. And to me, just watching them move is a mesmerizing experience because they cruise at a fairly reasonable speed, and then suddenly, with a flick of their tail, they're almost out of sight. They can go so fast almost instantly. And because they move so gracefully and so beautifully, I have stood in front of that tank for hours, and the people kind of look at me suspiciously. What's this guy doing? I mean, a fish is a fish, right? How much can you stare at a fish? But in fact, because I am so fascinated by these creatures. They actually, in this very tank, that's where they kept the young white sharks that they had. And everybody crowded around there, and I was saying, get out of the way. I don't want to watch the shark. Let me just watch the tuna.
Show me the tuna. They're there in an aquarium in Monterey, and it is beautiful. But in the wild, how do they live? Where do they live? How do they travel? How far afield?
They live sort of like 800-pound gorillas wherever they want to. Mostly they live in cold and temperate waters. They breed in three parts of the world, and this is critical to the tuna story. They breed in the Mediterranean, they breed in the Gulf of Mexico, and they breed south of Indonesia.
Is between Indonesia and Australia, that patch?
In between Australia and Northern Australia and the Indonesian island chain. That's one of the places that they breed. And what happens almost in all those places, less so in the Pacific, but certainly in the Indian Ocean and certainly in the North Atlantic and the Mediterranean, people are catching half-grown tuna. They're catching them. They tow them in a pen, in a floating corral. They tow them to this pen. They keep them in a corral for 6 or 8 months, and they fatten them up.
I'm going to ask you a favor. Before we pen them, I want to picture them wild. We know they're going to end up penned in our conversation here. But when they're in the wild, so they're spawning in these three areas, how far do they travel? Do they roam everywhere on the planet?
They used to think that there were two separate North Atlantic populations of tuna. Western North Atlantic one that bred in the Gulf of Mexico and the Eastern North Atlantic one that bred in the Mediterranean.
And you're talking bluefin again here?
I'm only talking bluefin here. If it sounds like I'm not talking bluefin, let me know, because that's the fish of choice here.
Yeah.
They therefore divided the ocean in half, and they said the people in the western part can fish for the western population, the people in the eastern part can fish for the eastern. It turned out that they mix. They mix, and it's not clear why or how they do that, but they are the most powerful swimmers of any fish. Individual tuna can swim across the North Atlantic from the Mediterranean to New England, swim there in a couple of weeks, and if they don't get interrupted by a net, they can turn around and swim back.
They can and they do.
And they can and they certainly do. They know this because they've tagged them and they've marked them and they tag them over here, and 2 weeks later, there's that fish over there.
And the same in the Pacific, that kind of range.
Yeah. Well, they can swim. Actually, they do swim across the Pacific Ocean from California to Japan. These are the powerful migratory fishes, and we're not exactly sure of why they make these journeys. We can easily figure out the journey that they need to make to breed, to get to the breeding area where the conditions are exactly right for their breeding. But why a fish would swim across the Pacific Ocean and turn around and swim back is not clear.
Now, they're unusual also for sea creatures, for fish in their body temperature. Explain that for us.
Tuna, as well as some of the mackerel sharks are the great white, the mako, and the poor beagle, and the swordfish, and some of the marlins, have a heat exchange mechanism in their bodies, which means that they can take cooled blood, warm it up by getting it close to their muscles, warm it up, and then circulate that warm blood so that their muscles get warmer. A warmed athlete, think about athletes warming up, is more efficient than a cold one. And tuna can raise their temperature higher than any other fish.
And when and why would they do that?
They would do that because it makes them more efficient. It makes them capable of swimming greater distances, capable of swimming faster, capable of catching their prey
fish. So when they're getting set to feed, or when they feel, do they have adrenaline? When there's an emergency, or
they don't even need an emergency. Mm-hmm. They function that way.
Just heat it up and off they go.
One of the tuna researchers said at one point, describing this kind of mechanism, she said, this was Barbara Block, she said, they're almost mammals. Because mammals maintain a steady body temperature. Fish, by and large, do not. A codfish swimming in 40-degree water off New England will have a 40-degree temperature. A tuna swimming in 40-degree water can have a 75 or 80-degree temperature. They're always heated up because they're always ready to move.
And what's the range and size of your beloved bluefin tuna?
The range and size, well, they're born. When they first hatch, they're about the size of a grain of rice. They get to be 12, 13 feet long and can weigh as much as 1,500 pounds. And there are different categories of tuna that are fished for differently. But when they get to be large enough, 700 or 800 pounds, that's when they're ready to breed. And those are the fish that we're concerned about, because they're not only ready to breed, they're ready to farm.
Why do the Japanese love the great bluefin tuna so much? And what portion of the world's harvest goes there?
Almost all of it. Almost all of the harvest of bluefin tuna goes to Japan.
From every corner of every harbor.
every corner of every harbor. There are people waiting outside of Gloucester and Barnstable, Mass, for someone to Japanese people, for someone to bring in a big tuna. They buy it on the dock immediately, and it is flown to Japan.
Now, I've eaten plenty right there in Tokyo and all over Japan of exactly that tuna, and not only in Japan, seen people eat it all over the world. But you tell us, why so beloved?
Well, you haven't eaten that much bluefin tuna, first of all. What you eat in sushi in this country...
Well, I spent 5 years in Tokyo, so...
but then you said you eat it parts of the world. What happens is that the Japanese favor the fatty belly meat of the tuna. Mm-hmm. This would not go over very well in America because it's red meat. Mm-hmm. If you opened a can of tuna fish and it looked like a hamburger...
Bright, jewel-like red.
Yeah, you'd mm-hmm. say, wait a minute, mm-hmm. this is not what I had in mind. Mm-hmm. But the Japanese, and it's hard to explain why. I mean, it's a mania currently going on in Japan. It's a monstrous, and I use the word advisedly, it's a monstrous fad. There are restaurants that serve a piece of tuna the size of a deck of cards for $100. Then they serve another one. The Japanese are mad to do this, and they are essentially eating this fish out of existence because they make the market for all the bluefin tuna.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound there from Tsukiji Market in Tokyo, the largest fish market in the world. Every day, fresh and frozen bluefin tuna auctioned off to the highest bidder, and a whole lot of them, but not as big as they used to be because so many have been fished. We're talking about the fate of the tuna this hour. Bluefin tuna, world's most desired fish, in trouble. The big ones gone and going, and the future of those left now hinging maybe on unproven tuna farming or the domestication of the tuna, the bluefin tuna. My guest is Richard Ellis, author of Tuna, A Love Story. All right, talk about ranching tuna and farming or domesticating tuna. They're not the same thing. You began to describe what's going on. I guess it first started in Boston Bay, but not this Boston where we're sitting. Boston Bay in Australia, where what? They go out to sea, they round up great nets full of live tuna, bring them back. How's it work? What's happening?
They spot them from the air, first of all.
Schools of tuna.
They travel in large schools.
Like how many?
20,000 fish.
Oh, that's
per
big.
School. And when you do that, just a footnote here, when you do that and you see 20,000 fish, you can't see them all at once, but when you see 20,000 fish, you say, we can't even make a dent in this mm-hmm. kind of population. Let's just catch this 20,000 right. mm-hmm. and that one over there. What they do is they surround them with a purse seine. They purse the net.
A purse seine, meaning, describe that for those who aren't fishermen,
like,
that
like
kind of net.
It's like a gigantic purse mm-hmm. that is closed
net.
At the bottom mm-hmm. and then pinched together mm-hmm. at the top. Mm-hmm. Then they tow the fish in that purse seine to a corral, a floating corral. They turn
way
them,
out at sea.
This is 5 or 10 miles out.
Okay.
So it could be even more, but it's not in the middle of the ocean.
Okay, okay.
They take that net full of fish, and they transfer them by having a trapdoor in the net and a trapdoor in this big corral. Mm-hmm. Then they tow them in the corral mm-hmm. closer to shore. This is now taking place in Western Australia and Southern Australia.
How do they get them from the purse seine net out at sea into the corral out at sea? How do they?
They join the two together.
The
two together. They open. Trap
and
doors.
Wait for them to swim through the
trap?
They
drive them out. They jump in the net.
So these are like scuba divers or
yeah.
something? Or so these are the wranglers, the tuna
yeah,
cowboys.
That's right. These are the cowboys. They've even made two films about this exercise. One was called Tuna Wranglers and mm-hmm. the other was called Tuna Cowboys.
Mm-hmm.
Once they're in a floating pen off of Adelaide in South Australia, off of Port Lincoln, then they keep them there. They keep them there for 6 or 8 months, fattening them. They feed them twice a day. They feed them fish, not surprisingly. And
sardines.
Of course, sardines and pilchards, mm-hmm. Which they have to buy, and mm-hmm. you have to farm these fish to get to feed the tuna something. So the fish they're feeding the tuna are becoming endangered because there's enormous quantities of them being fished out. In any event, they feed them till they get to be 200 or 300 pounds. Then they kill them.
So when they bring them, they tend to be what size?
They can be anywhere from 100 to 200 pounds. They feed them.
So this is like a fattening pen, kind
it's
of.
Like, yeah, it's
like you might find in Wyoming.
It's a feedlot technology.
Mm-hmm.
Only the difference between tuna and cattle, say, is cattle, you start from scratch. You start,
right.
You breed them, and then one has
from the wild.
This you start with half-grown fish.
So, and then these divers go in, they one by one choose the biggest ones?
Ultimately they get them all.
They must be pulling them. You say they feed them until they're ready to be slaughtered, essentially.
Right. And then they slaughter every single one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they freeze them or not, ship them to Japan, and those are the fish that you see, not only from Australia, but also from other parts of the world. Those are the fish that you see every single day, rank after rank of frozen bluefin tuna at the Tsukiji Fish Market in Tokyo.
Is that most of what's now consumed of bluefin tuna? Ranched in this way, caught in the wild,
absolutely.
Fed in the lot?
Absolutely, but even Australia, even Australia is small potatoes compared to what's happening in Europe. In the Mediterranean, every single country on the Mediterranean, Spain, France, Italy, Greece, Croatia, Tunisia, Morocco, Algeria, and even countries in the Mediterranean like Cyprus and Malta are doing exactly
same
this.
Same technique.
Catching
same
the bluefin tuna and a lot of it, and they're catching them out. They're fishing them out in the Mediterranean, so much so that the World Wildlife Fund has called for a complete cessation of tuna fishing in the Mediterranean because they're deeply concerned, and correctly, that if this intensive fishing goes on in the Mediterranean, we won't have any tuna left.
Now, there was a time, I know, when I used to know buddies who worked their way through college, as I recall, harpooning tuna at sea, big ones, very big ones.
Yeah.
So you can harpoon, you can catch with rod and reel, and you can net all three. Are all three used, or are the...
Well, netting is the commercial application of tuna fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Harpooning is what is done not only off New England, but it's also done to some extent in the Mediterranean. Tuna can be harpooned, but of course what happens when you harpoon a fish is you're talking about getting one at a time. When you throw a purse seine around them, you're talking about getting 10,000 at a time.
Let's hear a little bit of that tuna ranching going on here. The Discovery Channel has made a couple of series about the tuna ranching industry in the Pacific, and of course, this is where they're gathered together, fattened up, and then pulled out, killed, sent off to Japan. Of course, sharks would like to get in that pen too. Here's a little bit where one of those divers, a tuna wrangler, this is from Tuna Wranglers, glorifying the exploits and daily lives of the tuna ranchers.
If a shark bites just one tuna, that's a potential loss of tens of thousands of dollars. It has to be gotten rid of. Shooting is a last resort. Damo's going to try and wrestle the shark out of the pen with his bare hands.
That is some valuable tuna when you dive in to wrestle sharks out of the pen with your bare hands. Let's hear from our listeners. Chris is calling from Boston. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you know, Chris?
I'm a recreational fisherman, actually, avid saltwater fisherman, and we target the smaller bluefin tuna here locally. We fish off of Rhode Island in August when the small ones come in, and then in Cape Cod Bay and off Mass Bay up in the Stellwagen.
What does small mean in pounds, Chris? What's small?
The ones off Rhode Island are small, 20, 30 pounds.
Okay.
And then the ones in Cape Cod Bay that we go after are, 50 to 100 pounds. A little over 100 pounds is kind of the max for what we're doing.
And you're looking to get them on a hook?
Yeah, fly rod, actually, fly fishing for them. And a lot of people use spin fishing for them as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great recreational fish. I mean, I'm curious if your guest knows anything about the health of the juvenile population and the relative impact to the recreational sport fishing impact to the population. I mean, it doesn't seem, based on, comparison to seiners, that there would be much of an impact, but I'm always curious on that.
Yeah, you're out there catching them and like to know how to feel about it or where it fits into the big picture. Richard Ellis, how about it? Chris is out there. He enjoys catching them with the reel, pretty young ones.
I don't think,
is there a big impact of recreational tuna fishing?
I don't think recreational tuna fishing has much of an impact on the tuna population. Even if a lot of people are catching even a lot of tuna, at that size, there are a lot of them out there to catch. Now, that doesn't make it necessarily easy to catch them, but there are a lot of them out there. What happens is tuna change their habits as they grow larger, and they go to different feeding areas.
Okay.
So off New England, I used to live in Little Compton, Rhode Island, and I used to go fishing with a guy called Bud Phillips, who's a sword fisherman out of Little Compton. But in fact, this doesn't have much of an effect, and I don't object to any part of the recreational fishery. It's the mass slaughter that I'm objecting to, and I'm objecting to it because it's driving the fish to extinction.
It's also making some people very rich. The little town is or city, 14,000. Port Lincoln, is it, Australia, with more millionaires than any per capita than any, or maybe just period, than any other city in Australia. It's real money.
I was there last year. I went to look at the tuna industry down in Port Lincoln. And it is a phenomenal thing to look at because I first went there in 1985. I was writing an article for National Geographic. And in 1985, the tuna fishing took place offshore. Guys went out in tuna boats and sometimes even caught them on rod and reel.
But they weren't ranching. They weren't
And then
pulling in these thousands to raise in the bay.
And what happened is one of the local, it was actually a Croatian rather than an Australian, but he lives in Australia. He tried this ranching business. He tried purseining them and feeding them because he knew that somehow if he could have more of them for sale to the Japanese, he would make more money. And so he introduced that first into South Australia with many other local tuna fishermen. What happened is Port Lincoln, South Australia, where I was last year, turned into this thriving, very strange,
super
rich
tuna center.
Super fishing center with big houses on the beach and big marinas and huge restaurants and hotels. Nobody ever goes there.
And lots of tuna cowboys and, who go there.
Well, the locals are the guys
wranglers.
Who drive the boats and pull in the nets. And the millionaires are the people who own these companies. And they sell quotas back and forth. They trade quotas. So you're there is a quota set up by the government, and it's portioned out. Somebody who wants to make some money can sell his particular part of the quota for $20 or $30 million.
When you catch them wild, fatten them in the bay, and then sell them, you're not helping that wild population. Is there a chance that it could be turned into a domesticated, you know, husbandry, farming, that you could actually breed bluefin tuna in captivity instead of sweeping the seas of them?
One of the reasons I went to South Australia was because I knew that one of these companies, a company called Clean Seas, had built an enormous facility, including a 790,000-gallon tank, in which they wanted to make or get bluefin tuna to spawn. If they could get them to spawn and raise them from this tiny little size, they would change the very nature of bluefin tuna fishing.
How's that going?
When I left there last year, they had tried it. They had breeding size, 700 or 800 pound males and females in this big tank. They are able to control the temperature and the light level, everything to make the fish think they're in the waters off Indonesia, which is where this particular population breeds, and they failed. So I came back and last year, and I said, oh, well, and I wrote in the book, I wrote, well, eventually they might succeed, but so far they haven't, so the tuna populations are still plummeting because everybody's still fishing for them. This year, in March of this year, 2008, they succeeded. They got bluefin tuna to breed. If this works, and these people at Clean Seas are very experienced at raising fish from eggs. They do it with other creatures, so it's not a big surprise to them, and they're not learning on the spot. But if they succeed and can raise, and the only people who do this, the Japanese have done it in a tiny little fashion, raising two or three at a time. The Australians are thinking of or trying to raise them thousands at a time. They will build the necessary nets to raise them, they will feed them, and that, if they succeed, will completely change the nature of tuna fishing, because instead of catching them all before they're old enough to breed, they will be breeding them. And they're prepared, of course, to export this technology, not cheaply. But when I was there, I wasn't allowed to take any pictures. I wasn't allowed to make any notes.
But the price is right that this may spread. We'll talk about what the impact of that might be. We've got a lot of fishermen and others who want to talk with you. Rob in Newburyport, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Rob.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi, Rob.
I have the book, and I was really delighted to see that I live in Newburyport, but every summer I travel a couple hundred miles south down to Snug Harbor, Rhode Island, and fish with really a legendary guy named Al Anderson, and he wrote a book called To Catch a Tuna, and I was, when I started fishing with him, I was relieved to know not only does he catch tuna, but he releases a majority of the fish he actually catches.
Mm.
And I was curious to hear your comment on what he's doing and the meaningfulness of it.
Well,
Richard.
I was in touch with Al Anderson when I was writing this book, and I managed to find him. I talked to him on the phone. He sent me an autographed copy of his book. I sent him an autographed copy of mine. He is in the sort of vanguard of conscientious, ecologically minded fishermen. In other words, he tags a lot of them. He releases a lot of them. He obviously keeps some of them. He's not in it just for eleemosynary reasons. But in fact, when
did you say eleemosynary reasons?
Yeah, that's what I said.
What's that?
That means to try and only do good.
Oh, very good. All right, thank you.
Sorry about that.
Philanthropic fishing.
It escaped from me.
Okay.
But I was in touch with him, and a couple of the pictures in the book were provided by him, in fact. And I was very happy to be in touch with him. I was in touch with all kinds of people to write this book. I was in touch with European fishermen. Obviously, I was in touch with a lot of Australians. I was in touch with a lot of scientists. I was in touch with everybody I thought could help to clarify the picture of the bluefin tuna in today's world.
Including Al Anderson. We'll talk with Ken Frazier in a minute, who caught the biggest ever. Let's go to Eric in Gloucester, Massachusetts, great fishing center. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Richard.
Hi.
I just had a question for you, Richard. I fished bluefin for years. We've caught, in any season, anywhere from 30 to 35 fish, big ones, you know, 800 to 900 pounds.
Wow.
This year, compared to last, mm-hmm. We've caught a couple fish this year, compared to last year, which is about 32. I've just noticed here in Gloucester, I mean, and I think everywhere, the fishing's way off this year. And from what our understanding is, it just seems to be that there's no fish around. And I'm just wondering if you could maybe comment on why you think that is. And from our understanding, it's pretty much the purse seining that's happening in the Mediterranean that's basically killing the groups of fish that are coming back and forth across the ocean.
So you read it, Eric, as the big nets in the Mediterranean scooping up what you might have at one time caught right there off the northeast coast of the U.S.?
That's our understanding. I'm actually looking at one of the purse seiners out my window right now that's been tied up in Gloucester, one of the U.S. purse seiners, I think there's four. I'm looking at it. It has not moved all year long. There just seems to be no fish here.
Nothing to
and
go for.
My understanding is there's hundreds and hundreds of boats that actually purse seine them overseas in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, Eric, I'm so glad you called. We just got a minute before the break, but what do you know, Richard Ellis?
That the tuna cross the Atlantic Ocean. Those that breed in the Mediterranean would, if they were allowed to do so, come to the east coast of the United States and Canada and feed in Nova Scotia and Newfoundland and off Massachusetts as well, in the Gulf of Maine. But if they're all caught, or not all of them, but if so many are being caught in the Mediterranean, they don't get a chance to grow up. They don't get a chance to migrate. These are great migratory creatures. So fish that are born in the Mediterranean very easily can swim to Newfoundland or Newburyport.
35 last year for Eric, 2 this year. Is that story repeated in other parts of the world?
You need a longer sample to really know that. But yes, the numbers are being severely depleted. Whether or not there will be none the next year, or 38 the next year, we can't tell. You can't tell from 1 year, because this is not a big fish tank. You can't say we pulled all the fish out, therefore there are no fish.
Eric, thanks for your call. We're going to take a short break. We're talking with Richard Ellis. His new book is Tuna, A Love Story. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the fate of the tuna, the bluefin tuna, maybe the world's most desired fish, and it's in trouble. The big ones gone and going, and the future a real big question mark. My guest is Richard Ellis. His new book, You Can Learn Everything Here, is Tuna, A Love Story. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Zane Grey, the cowboy writer, fished tuna. Ernest Hemingway, super writer, fished for tuna, but neither of them caught as big a tuna as my guest now, Ken Frazier. He in 1979, he caught the largest tuna ever. He's the world record holder, a 1,496-pound bluefin in 1979. He wrote about it in a book called Possessed. You can find out more, link to his website at ours. He joins us right now from Bridgetown, Nova Scotia. Ken Fraser, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Can you describe that day and that catch? Where were you? What was it like?
It was a memorable day back in 79. We were fishing at the causeway between Nova Scotia and Cape Breton Island, and there was a lot of fish around, and we were very lucky. We caught 7 fish in 9 days, and one of them was a world record. It was quite a fishing trip.
Give us a sense of the physical act of catching a tuna that size.
Tom, it's like hooking onto a truck going 60 miles an hour. It's like hauling a safe up 20 floors in a building and having it fall down 10 times before you get it to the top. It's a lot of work. The tuna is a very powerful fish. The marlin is more spectacular, but the tuna is tougher.
What's the setup? The rod, the reel, the heart. You must be harnessed into your boat. The bait. How did it work?
You're sitting in a fighting chair, and you have a harness that is attached to the rod and reel. But you're physically not tied to the chair. You can physically go overboard if the reel has a drag system on it, which doesn't allow the fish to pull you overboard.
Mm-hmm. And what bait would you have been using?
We use mackerel, like a daisy chain, and we'd have 6 or 7 mackerel as teasers, and then the last one would have the hook in it, and we would float that on the surface behind the boat, and the tuna would actually come right up to the surface of the water and take it right at the surface.
Did you know you had an especially big one?
No, we actually caught this tuna at 9 o'clock in the morning, and we towed that fish around all day. We couldn't get it in the boat, and we had no idea how big it was, and until we got in that night, 10 o'clock at night, and tried to get it up on the wharf, and it was so huge that it was just mind-boggling. The fish probably, in those 10 hours, would have dehydrated probably 20, 30, 40, 50 pounds.
But it's still in at 1,496 pounds. You've called tuna fishing an addiction, like gambling or smoking or drinking.
It's an addiction. It's something you have to do. It's like gambling, smoking, or drinking. You just have to do it, and you're possessed. You're possessed to go to go catch this tuna, and everything is driven by the weight. You catch a tuna, the first thing you want to do is weigh it, and everything is driven by the weight of the tuna. It's not the size or how pretty it is. It's how much does it weigh. Everybody wants to know how much it weighed.
Ken, it looks like I may have a caller who knows something about that kind of catch. Right now on the line from Cape Cod, Massachusetts, is Marlene. I think this is Marlene Goldstein. Marlene, are you there?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
I've got a note here that says you are the world record holder, female world record holder, for catching tuna. 1,228 pounds, 1984, U.S. World record.
Correct. Women's and a U.S. waters record.
Describe when you caught your big one, Marlene. Where was it? What did it feel like?
Well, it's interesting. Right now I'm sitting looking at Sandy Neck Dunes, and we caught it 2 miles off the parking lot at Sandy Neck Beach. So it was in fairly shallow water, so fish never really sounded, never really got deep.
Mm-hmm.
I was on the surface most of the time, so it took me 2 hours. And
What size boat were you in, Marlene?
A 40-foot boat.
Okay.
And the fish weighed 10 times what I weigh.
With a 40-foot boat, who pulls who when you've got a 1,200-pound tuna on the line?
Well, what you do, it's a harness, and you just rock back and forth. You use your feet push, and your harness, the seat goes back, and the rod comes up, and then you just reel on the way down. It's just rocking motion. But when the fish wants to go, it just goes. You just let it go.
Ken?
And then you just have to kind of work it back in.
Yeah. Ken Fraser, in Nova Scotia, do you see anything? I mean, 1979 was your catch. Marlene's was 1984. Ken, you're 70-something now. Do you see anything of that scale anymore out there for bluefin?
You know, the bluefin tuna, they run in cycles. And in where I fished at North Lake, we caught many world records, as many as three in one day. And in 1986, the fish where I fished just absolutely disappeared, and they disappeared for 9 years. They didn't come back until 1995. And there are a lot of fish around now. They're fishing them now, but they're a lot smaller fish. It's hard to know where these bigger fish, where have they gone? Nobody knows.
Marlene, what's your sense? Are they even out there anymore? Maybe they're not.
I really believe that my record will not be broken. I really don't. I don't think those fish are out there anymore.
How do you feel about that? Does it make you feel?
Smallest fish I ever caught was 806 pounds.
Oh, tiny.
In Cape Cod Bay, we used to fish with Charlie Mayo from Provincetown, who was the king of tuna fishing. He invented the multiple rig. We used to fish with squid, and we got the highest price ever at that time, $4.50 a pound. But prior to that, you know, we fished with Charlie Mayo in the 60s. They used it for cat food. There was no money in it.
Richard Ellis is with me in the studio. Richard, there was a time at which, maybe still, but probably not right now, tuna brought more per pound than gold.
It probably does now.
Gold's pretty high now.
But the most expensive fish, I feel sorry for Marlene who sold hers at the wrong time, the most expensive fish ever sold of any kind was a bluefin tuna that was sold at the fish market in Tokyo for $173,000. One fish. $173,000 for one fish.
Marlene and Ken, I've got to ask you, Richard and others, maybe yourselves are worried that these big bluefin are going to become history, that they could be fished essentially to extinction. Do you think one day, Ken, I'll come first to you on this, are people going to look back on you as a kind of buffalo hunter, who sort of hunted them right off the face of the earth?
I hope not. Right now, we're in Prince Edward Island, there seems to be a lot of young fish, fish that are 7 or 8 years old, and those are your breeding stock. And they seem to be there in pretty good numbers. So if they're not overfished by the commercial seiners and what have you, these fish do have a chance to come back. A huge fish, a record fish, is probably 25, 35 years old. But right now there seems to be a lot of young fish in the water, and that is a very good sign.
Marlene Goldstein, what do you think? They're going to look at you as a buffalo hunter, the one who, took one of the last big ones?
I hope not. But it just seems that the government needs to do more. There has to be more regulations. There has to be more quotas. And the purse seiners are the ones who really, really kill the fish population. It's not us, it's not us rod and reel people. It's not even the harpooners.
Richard Ellis is nodding.
After we started fishing, they used to come out here with planes. For the harpooners, because the fish got so dear, you could get so much money for it.
It was worth spotting from the air, chasing them down with your boat and harpoon.
One at a time,
yeah. Marlene Goldstein, world record holder for the tuna. You caught 1,228 pounds in 1984. I'm glad you called in. And Ken Frazier in Bridgetown, Nova Scotia, the world record holder, 1,496-pound bluefin tuna in 1979. Ken, thank you very much for joining us today.
I enjoyed being on, Tom. Thank you very much for having me.
Ken Frazier wrote Possessed, and you can link to his website at ours, onpointradio.org. Let's take a call from Panama City, Florida. Lewis, you're on the air.
Yes, gentlemen. I just wanted to comment. I was a broker for like 18 years, chasing fish from Mexico to Nova Scotia.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the only thing I could add is in regards to the price. It was really, I could buy 40 fish in one day and pay $50 a pound on one fish and $2 a pound on another, caught right next to each other from the same fleet. So
why that disparity, Lewis? You're the broker. I wouldn't.
Because of fat content, color, the way the fish was caught, they could actually burn their meat if they were kind of horsed into the...
If they struggled too much, but it's...
They grade the blood so high that it actually makes the meat brittle.
Right.
And plus, they're aggressive feeders, so some are eating better than others.
But if it looked good to, if it would look good to a sushi chef in Tokyo, it was going to bring that high price. And what do you see out there now, Lewis?
Well, I got out of the business because of the decline of the stock and regulations and the farming in Australia. The last 3 years, I actually was importing some here because I used to sell domestically also. So now it's just, you know, after all this time, it's just not like it used to be. There's not as many fish.
Can you imagine a day when bluefin tuna are farmed, spawning in captivity, and you know, it's not the wild tuna of the sea that's being pulled in and swept away?
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, we're on that path now, not only with tuna, but many, many species. You know, flounder, all kinds of species that they're farming and raising and from hatchlings, you know, just like they did with catfish and so on and so forth. It's only a matter of time, in my opinion, anyway.
Lewis, thank you for your call. Let me get another from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Fishing town again. Mark, you're on the air.
It's an interesting conversation, but I think that you're being a little one-sided.
One-sided in what respect? What do you mean by that, Mark?
Your listeners, I think, are getting the idea that everything is to the negative. The U.S. is operated under very strict catch regulations. We are highly regulated. I am, for example, running a tagging tournament in Gloucester this weekend, and over half of my boats are commercial boats that are contributing to the scientific effort.
A tagging tournament, in other words, who can tag the most tuna in particular in a given time?
Young tuners, the juveniles, we're doing this on behalf of one of the researchers in tuna from the University of New Hampshire.
But when our caller, Mark, says he caught 35 last year and 2 this year, you know, that doesn't sound too good.
No, it doesn't, but I'm the leading buyer here in Gloucester. I'm not sure who Eric is. I'm sure he may have sold to somebody else, but we are ahead this year on buying tuna in Gloucester. The biggest reason we've had problems recently was we've had a factory herring and midwater fleet here that has finally been severely curtailed in their efforts, and our waters are teeming with bait again, and we've had no bait here for 9 years. And I am seeing fish of quality that I haven't seen in 15 years.
Mark, stand by. Richard Ellis, what do you say? Mark is right in the middle of this, and he says it doesn't look quite that bad to him, and maybe even on the up.
I think what we're looking at, all of us are looking at, especially the record fishermen, they're looking at things that happened 15, 20 years ago.
But Mark's a buyer. He's buying now.
That's right. But you're looking at a peak that may not continue. I mean, obviously, the breeding cycles of fish are cyclical. They depend on a lot of different things, the availability of bait for the fish to eat, water temperature, any number of things. But what is really happening throughout the Atlantic Ocean is they are fishing out the breeding stock in the Mediterranean. Some of those fish would have made it across the ocean, but they didn't because they were caught and killed, fattened and killed and sent to Japan. So in terms of an actual cycle that we're looking at a downtrend. There will be bumps in the road here. You will see more fish. But over time, you will not. Over time, unless something drastic happens, you will not continue to see more fish.
Mark, we're glad for your perspective from Gloucester. Let's get one more from Panama City, Florida. Trudy, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Very well. What do you see, Trudy?
Well, I just know a lot of people in the fishing industry, and in the past, our state government has had to step in and regulate the purse seine boats particularly. They're just too efficient, and they pretty much regulated them for nothing but bait fishing. And I think our world organizations are going to have to step in and do the same thing.
Worldwide, you say, Trudy, thanks for that. Richard Ellis, is that in the cards? I mean,
It is not in the cards at the moment, largely because the organization, ICAT, the International Convention for the Conservation of Atlantic Tunas, is utterly ineffectual. It is populated by the fishing countries, and mostly the United States belongs, Japan belongs, but all the European countries belong. And the European countries refuse to have quotas administered. And if they are administered, they refuse to abide by them. They cheat. They catch We're talking about thousands of tons of fish here. We're not talking about one fish that mm-hmm. weighs this and another mm-hmm. fish that weighs that. We're talking about thousands of tons. The Libyans, the Tunisians, the Spaniards, the Italians, the French, all of them are overfishing the Mediterranean, hysterically overfishing the Mediterranean, because there is so much money to be made in it, and it is all ultimately coming from Japan.
You know,
and we can't control that fishery. Nobody can.
We've just got a minute here, and we hear that woe. And I wouldn't want to be one of those tuna in a pen waiting to be rounded up and chopped. But of course, people want to eat this. But I'd rather go out thinking of one of the great ones who's still out there, wherever it may be, in the big blue sea, and just them swimming. You've watched a lot of them. Just give us a sense of what it's like when they're out at free and swimming.
It's a magical feeling to find yourself that close to one of these magnificent creatures, and your heart breaks when you think that they're not going to be around that much longer. I admire Ken Fraser. I think he and Marlene are people who love the tuna as I do. They approach it somewhat differently, but still, the whole love story aspect of this book has to do with people who admire the fish the way I do, with people who fish for them, like Ken and Marlene, with people who eat them as well, and people who are trying to ranch them. So the whole tuna concept is a fascinating one.
But we know great creatures can go away. Let's watch out. Richard Ellis, thanks so much for being with us. The new book is Tuna, A Love Story. Richard, thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.